I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. It's bird news this morning with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Do you hear that? Hear that? Hear them?
I hear nothing.
Butterflies. You can't hear them. We're going to start with butterflies this morning. Yeah. So you are out there counting. This is the July 4th annual butterfly count.
Yeah. So, yeah, so this is a thing, whether you knew it or not.
I love that.
And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
make fun of us butterflies.
No,
people.
I think I want to do that next year. I love butterflies.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun, and if you like being a naturalist, you're into just kind of sleuthing out natural history. It's a great way to do that. I mean, it gets you out in the field and looking at bugs and learning your plants. And, you don't have to learn your plants necessarily to get into birds. You know, you learn the birds. But when you start getting into the insects, butterflies, you need to start learning your plants,
right,
too.
Some of the plants.
And
but
before
I don't
know it, you're a good all-around naturalist.
Oh,
and so that's
fun.
You know, that's one of the things I like about it. But so there's a, there's a national organization for butterflies, the North American Butterfly Association, NABBA. Mm-hmm. And similar to the Christmas bird counts that National Audubon organizes every winter, this is a summer July census of butterfly populations all over the continent. And so it's the same thing. It's like a circle. There's someone in charge, a compiler. I'm the compiler for the Truro one, which we did yesterday. And so you assemble a team and you spend a day in the field covering a specific geographic area, counting, butterflies. So it's the same, similar to the birds. You try to hit all of the different types of habitats to maximize your species diversity, because you want to, be able to document what's out there and whether populations are changing over time, obviously, is the goal. And doing it long term is how you do that. And they've been going on for a while. So the data is very useful for looking at trends. And, it's hard to talk about butterflies without getting into the monarchs. That's most people's touchstone for butterflies,
right. Everybody
is
knows
monarchs.
That one, yeah.
But there's so many other species out there. A lot of them are little. Mm-hmm. People may not realize they're butterflies. Monarch is such a big butterfly. And maybe people think that that's what butterflies look like. But most of the species are way, way smaller than monarchs. Things like skippers and little pearl crescents. And the cabbage whites, yeah, that's a non-native species that's pretty ubiquitous, probably hanging around your gardens. Mm-hmm. They're a garden pest for us, too. They get your lettuce and things. Anything in the mustard family, they'll hit those cabbage whites. But there's lots of, native species out there that are kind of interesting. Like one of the things we do on the Truro one is we go up to Hatches Harbor, where there are all these native cranberry bogs.
Oh, wow.
Natural wild cranberry bogs out in the dune slack wetlands out there. And so they're full of wild cranberries, same plant that they grow in the commercial cranberry bogs. And they were all in flower. And there's a particular species that you can only find in there called the bog copper.
Oh, wow.
And it's a, it's a little thing. The average person would say, oh, it's a little moth, kind of flitting around. But it's a species that only occurs in those wild cranberry bogs and probably commercial ones if they didn't spray the hell out of them. But but they're definitely in the wild ones. Hatches Harbor is full of those. And I love getting out into just gets you out into habitats you wouldn't otherwise go into. And these are the places the tourists aren't going.
You had a good day for it yesterday.
Poison ivy, yeah. Mosquitoes,
oh, no.
Yeah. and another one of the benefits is you get to some of the blueberry patches that nobody else is getting to because they're in the, they're in the middle of some fetid swamp by the average person's standards, swatting away mosquitoes and, more poison ivy. But there was some really nice high bush blueberries out there. That's one of the fringe benefits, just sort of grazing your way along. And there are certain species that you find in among the, like the striped hair streak is something you would find among the high bush blueberries. So you're learning to read, the habitats. What plants will be associated with what species and where to look. And it's like a scavenger hunt. And it's really fun. If you're into being a naturalist, it's a really fun way to interact with nature.
I'm going to have to bone up because I can't identify too many different species.
I'll learn you.
Okay,
I'll learn
good.
You all about the butterflies.
I think it sounds like a lot of fun. So I'm just kind of anecdotally, I know you haven't seen what everybody's counted, but does it seem like the butterfly population was doing okay? Because I'm just saying, looking in my yard, it's tough.
It's been a weird year. I've seen very little. And, some of the plants are a little behind in flowering. We found some really nice patches of common milkweed. Mm-hmm. Like we go to the Highland Golf Course there by Highland Light, and it's a nice, it's kind of a natural looking landscape around the edges of the golf course. And there's these patches of milkweed And milkweed is like gold this time of year. It doesn't bloom for very long, but when it's blooming,
right.
I know people probably know that milkweed is the host plant for the caterpillars of monarchs. And we saw some big, juicy monarch caterpillars on the milkweeds, and we saw several adult monarchs. Often we don't see any.
Yeah,
we literally have years where we don't see a single monarch on this count, but this year we had more than 10, so that counted
good.
As a good year.
Yeah.
And we saw several caterpillars, so that was good. But the flowers of milkweed, all the milkweeds, swamp milkweed is one you should grow in your garden. It's really easy to grow. The monarchs will lay their eggs on it, and then every possible insect will visit the flowers for nectar. I mean, even hummingbirds will sometimes, but yeah. Native bee and wasp and butterfly will visit butterfly weed or swamp milkweed or common milkweed.
Yeah, I've been complaining about the fact that I've got fewer bee species in my garden. I used to have so many different kinds of bees, but I have this milkweed growing now, and I was out yesterday looking around going, wow, there are a number of bees I haven't seen in a while. So I'm really excited that these pollinators are back.
Yeah, the bee diversity pops in summer. You know, there are some spring species that are out in the spring and, you know, solitary nesting native bees that they're out in the spring, they provision their nests, and then they go away. But when it gets to be July, everything really starts popping around here. The butterfly diversity skyrockets, the bee diversity goes way up. And I really encourage people to look at the bees in their garden, because there's some really interesting ones out there. Beautiful little green metallic bees.
How about those really dark blue ones, those big ones that are like a really dark, dark, dark blue?
Is it a bee or a wasp?
It's a wasp, yeah.
It's a wasp.
Yeah.
So wasps are one of the things I like to talk about. They're a bit of a hard sell. Once you say wasp to somebody, they instantly, it's like fight or flight.
They go
into some memory of when a, you know, yellow jacket stung them when
yellow
they were a kid or something.
Yellow jackets are bad, yeah.
But that's not, I mean, there's so many. When I'm talking about wasps, I'm talking about the dozens and dozens and dozens of other species that some of them are so tiny you never see them. Mm-hmm. They're parasitoids and parasites on other insects. They have incredibly interesting, intricate life history connections with other species. And a lot of them are beneficial just around your garden. Mm-hmm. So there are certain flowers that they like that you can plant to attract them. Things with small white flowers seem to attract them. They do love milkweed. Mm-hmm. Mountain mint is a good... It's not always easy to find at the nurseries, but that's one you can grow in your garden to attract some of these beneficial wasps. But they're flying around, you know, picking caterpillars off of your garden plants, potentially. One of the interesting things we saw yesterday was there was a colony of this solitary nesting wasp that I had to look up. Mm-hmm. And they were obviously focusing in on this one particular kind of beetle. So the females are flying off into the forest, finding these, they're called buprestid beetles. It's a kind of... You may have seen them. They're like little oval-shaped, shiny beetles that bore into wood. And they were keying in on just this one particular kind of beetle, grabbing them, bringing them back to their nest in the sandy road up at Hatches Harbor, and then dragging them down in. You just find these beetles just sort of lying around in this little kind of loose colony of solitary wasps. I don't know. But people are turning off their radios. I love this stuff. People are falling asleep.
No, I love it too.
Settle down, wasp guy. Come on.
So things looked, from what you could say, 10 monarchs. So things were looking good, a little better this year than maybe last.
I think a lot of them had recently emerged. They look really fresh. So they were probably the next generation from the handful of monarchs that came through earlier in the summer or maybe even late spring that, you know, laid some eggs. And so this is our first, I think, local generation of monarchs that I was seeing yesterday. Really fresh and, like I said, probably recently emerged from their cocoon. So, yeah, that was a good sign. Always nice to see monarchs. And
what about
swallows?
Do you see a lot of swallowtail butterflies? Swallowtail?
Oh, swallowtails, yeah. Eastern tiger swallowtail is another one people probably know. They probably see them on their lilacs when the lilacs are blooming. And then they're out again now in mid-July. We saw several, and they're just gorgeous. And one of the weird things is that privet, which is a non-native invasive shrub that you can still buy at nurseries and people still use them for their hedges, but there's some real old ones, and bees love them, and butterflies really love them. And so we're hanging around these, you know, invasive non-native privet shrubs, just rubbernecking, and there's butterflies all over them. And the tiger swallowtails were one of them. And then spicebush swallowtail is another one that's really easy to see around here. Big, really big, all black with kind of iridescent blue on the hind wings. Mm-hmm. And they're usually flying, so it's hard to get a sense of them. But when you see a really big black butterfly,
they're gorgeous, yeah.
Yeah, like bigger than a monarch, that's going to be a spicebush swallowtail. And they're pretty common because the host plant for their larva is really common, and that's sassafras. Yeah. It's kind of a weedy edge tree that's really common on the Cape.
That's why I see them in my yard, yeah. There was one day, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, I saw three. First I saw the eastern swallowtail, I saw the black one with the blue, and there was a third one, which I can't remember right now, but I was like, wow, how lucky is that? Three in one day.
How am I going to teach you butterflies? You've already forgotten the spicebush swallowtail.
Right.
I just know,
in 2 seconds, right? Exactly. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or butterflies. We'll talk about any kind of critters around here.
Mammals, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I've got an email already. Amy says, I've been watching the osprey cam at the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History. During the recent hot weather, I noticed the birds seem to be panting, rather like dogs pant to keep cool. Do birds pant as a cooling mechanism?
Yes.
Yes.
We call it gaping, and we see it a lot, those of us who monitor tern colonies. You see it. You'll go into a tern colony on a hot day, and the birds are just sort of sitting there with their beaks open and the tongue kind of sticking out. And it's just a way for them to radiate heat. They can't sweat, you know. They're covered in feathers. They can't really radiate heat from their skin because they're covered in these insulating feathers. So they do their best to kind of radiate excess heat through the mouth lining, that kind of tissue there in the tongue. I don't know how effective it is, but that's what they have.
They
for
do
a,
it, so it must
for a
work.
System. Yeah, they can't sweat.
Yeah. Yeah, she also says, do males and females take turns feeding the young?
Yeah. Osprey. No. Well, there's some variation, but overwhelmingly the males do all of the fishing. Mm-hmm. I don't know about overwhelmingly, but that's the general pattern. Is so when they arrive in the spring, it's possible for the female to not have to catch her own fish again until September.
Wow.
And they arrive in March. So that's a long period. Mm-hmm. And so the males do the provisioning. They're sort of like, you know, the ospreys are like the 50s style kind of social system there. You know, the female is at the nest in her high heels greeting him when he gets home, you know. No, not really. But the females have the important duty of doing all of the incubation of the eggs, all of the feeding of the chicks. And protecting the chicks. And so they're at the nest protecting the chicks and incubating those eggs. And the male generally does the fishing, and he brings in the fish, and then the female takes it and feeds the chicks.
Right.
So they have a division of labor, and there's certainly flexibility in that. There are females that do more fishing than others. And there have been cases where a male was killed, and then the female had to do all of the duties.
She had to do
the fishing. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yep. All right, let's talk to Ann, who's giving us a call from East Orleans. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. This is a treat. I have a somewhat of an odd question. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in my driveway. We live in East Orleans, and we're pretty well covered with brush and trees. I heard something rustling off to the left, thought it was probably a squirrel, and out from the brush came what appeared to be a pigeon walking with a green band on its leg. And it just stood and stared at me. I moved quietly, and he moved up the driveway, stayed there for about 20 minutes, didn't seem to be injured. My daughter and I threw out some sunflower seed to see if that might be tempting, but at that, he turned and walked into the brush on the other side of the driveway and disappeared. He never tried to take flight, and I have been meaning to try to find out who would be banding a pigeon with a green band?
Right. So this is a common question, and it's pigeon fanciers. It's the people who keep and fly pigeons.
Oh.
One of the most famous ones is Mike Tyson, the boxer.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh my God.
Also, Bert from Sesame Street. maybe you've seen his dance, the pigeon.
Yes.
Anyway, so there are lots of clubs that keep pigeons, homing pigeons, racing pigeons, and they often end up off course, and they end up walking around tamely in somebody's backyard, and they're then they call us and say, "What do we do?" From what I've read, the people who keep these pigeons usually have a bunch of them, and they don't necessarily want the ones that didn't find their way home to they're like, oh, that one's broken. And so I'm not really sure what to do with them, but you can get, you know, if you get the information off the band, you might be able to Google something up in terms of what club it came from. It's not always easy. But you know, that's a bird that was kept by somebody in a cage and somehow got off course, and maybe it'll find its way back. Who knows?
And that would explain why it wasn't afraid and didn't fly away. Because it's around people.
Yes, yeah. They generally act really tame. Yeah.
Anne, thanks for the question and for listening. Appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More of your calls right after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Bob is calling from Eastham. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning.
Bob from Eastham.
Bob from Eastham,
Sounds sketchy.
Hey, Mark. I got a question about the dastardly chipmunks. I know for those of us who feed birds, chipmunks are a problem. But I also heard this weird story about a chipmunk who went chasing after a baby robin. So are they more annoying and more destructive to birds than just stealing their food?
Yes.
Oh,
never
wow.
Turn your back on a chipmunk. They're vicious. No, I'm serious.
They're so cute. You wouldn't think that.
They are cute.
That.
And so this is this
they're
is a thing.
People with robes.
Yeah. and so people don't realize a lot of these sort of, you know, fuzzy, cute wildlife from the Disney cartoons are vicious killers, and the chipmunk is no different. They will eat birds' eggs. They will eat nestlings.
Wow.
Ground squirrels, you know, gray squirrels, red squirrels, deer. Deer have been documented many times eating eggs, and definitely nestlings of ground nesting birds, just munching on baby birds. And we think of these animals as vegetarians, or maybe they'll eat some mushrooms and things. But they're opportunistic, and it's tough out there, and they'll take an opportunity to get some protein. The story that Bob is referring to, I know Bob, this is a planted question. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. but the story was that somebody saw, there was a baby robin hopping around in the yard, and there's a chipmunk all of a sudden out of nowhere just mauled this baby robin and just attacked it. And I think the robin got away, and that was surprising. That's not something I've ever seen, but there are all these documented cases of these cute little innocent-looking creatures, preying on other wildlife. Red squirrels, which are small, they're smaller than gray squirrels, but they're pretty they're pretty spirited, and they've been documented preying on baby rabbits.
Wow!
Little red squirrels.
Yeah, that's shocking.
So you'd never know. It's just I know. Just I'm shattering people's images of cute fuzzy wildlife out there. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Do you have any new ideas as to how to control them?
Control them.
You'd be rich if you did.
Yeah, that's for sure.
They will not be controlled.
They will not be.
They will not be contained. Nothing seems to do it. I mean, even in the years, couple of years ago, we had a really high red fox population on the Outer Cape. And you would see them walking around, and they seemed to be focusing on the chipmunks. And I would see them walking through my yard with three chipmunks in their mouth. And then I would look at my bird feeder, and the same number of chipmunks were there. Yeah. I mean, it's just there's no amount of predation that seems to be able
but
to control these guys.
Are there, you know, they have the squirrel-proof bird feeders. Do they have, I never saw that, but are there chipmunk-proof? You know that the...
Right,
the
chipmunks are much lighter than the squirrels, so they can usually...
Set it really...
The ones that are spring-loaded and go by the squirrel's weight to close the feeding ports, the chipmunks can often
get
around that, because they're lighter.
Yeah, I have happy, fat chipmunks in my yard.
I've honestly stopped feeding the birds in the summer because, I just end up feeding chipmunks. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why there are so many chipmunks is all the bird feeders.
Yeah, I didn't know that. All right, Bob, thanks for the question.
Yeah, love the show. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Bob.
Miranda is calling from Harwich. Hi, Miranda.
Hi. a couple of weeks ago, my family has a plot at the community gardens in Harwich, and a couple of weeks ago, my son and I were dealing with some very heavy weed, and we found a bird nest on the ground with four little sort of beige-colored eggs in it. We went back just yesterday, and the eggs and babies, everything was gone. Mm. And it's quite a substantial nest, probably an inch and a half from the very bottom to the bottom of the cup of the nest. And we saw what looked like a little songbird nearby, and I'm just not familiar with songbirds nesting on the ground. Just wondering if you could help us identify it.
On the ground in a community garden, you said?
Yes.
Was it in like a grass clump or it's in the weeds?
Yeah. Well, actually, it was very heavy weeds, but yes. You know, the weeds are probably about, they were high, maybe a foot high.
Yeah. I would guess song sparrow. A song sparrow is sort of the default backyard. I mean, every backyard has song sparrows nesting somewhere nearby, and they'll often nest on the ground in a grass clump. What did you say the eggs looked like?
They were beige.
I recall them as being beige or pinkish and very, very small. I mean, like teen, like smaller than the tip of my thumb.
Yeah.
And there was a very small songbird sort of perched in the chicken wire nearby.
Yeah, I would say almost certainly a song sparrow. I would have to look. I can't remember offhand what their eggs look like, but that, you know, most songbirds have kind of like pale eggs with brownish speckles. And I think they're no different.
I was not aware. I mean, I was aware of the seabirds doing you know, other things, but not songbirds on the ground. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Miranda.
Yeah, lots of things nest on the ground. Things that you wouldn't expect, including a lot of the forest birds who forage in the canopy, a lot of the warblers, where you would only ever see them when they're feeding, they're kind of high in the canopy of trees, will often nest on the ground. Mm-hmm. Or if not on the ground, then very low, like knee-high in some kind of a tangle. So a surprising number of songbirds will nest on or near the ground. Certainly lots of sparrows, towhees, the oven bird, which is a really common bird on Cape Cod. I don't know. They're famous for having these nests. Dan's not here. Usually he's quick on the call.
I think we have the oven bird on our list. We'll have to add it.
Yeah. All right. We'll get that on there. But they're a really common bird nesting in these pine oak forests we have so much of here in the Cape. And they nest on the ground, and they make this covered little domed nest. And that's where they get the name oven bird, because their nests sort of look like an old clay oven. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we have an email from Robbie who says, to be fair, I've asked this before. The response last time was more or less, that's an interesting question. It is an interesting question.
Uh-oh.
Why is it generally considered okay to feed birds, but not okay to feed wild animals?
It's a very good question.
Yeah. And some people say you should not feed the birds.
Oh, yeah. No. I know a wildlife biologist I know says that, you know, feeding birds leads to, like I said, more chipmunks, which leads to more foxes and more roadkills, which leads to more crows and more rats. And, you know, and that this is all true. Mm-hmm. And so we feed birds. I think some people sort of kid themselves that they're feeding the birds for the birds, or a lot of people, I think, you know, I'm taking care of the birds. And
no,
we feed the birds for us. It's for our entertainment. And so we're buying, you know, we're importing lots of sunflower seeds from the Midwest and putting them in feeders because we like to look at birds. I do it. We do it at the sanctuary. But there are some negative effects of that. It can increase window kills if you're attracting birds near your windows, you know, increases pests, that kind of thing. I guess when it comes to wild animals is sort of a broad term.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously feeding chickadees is not going to have the same potential negative consequences as feeding coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it's pretty obvious why it's okay to feed birds and not the other.
There are some people who will feed skunks or raccoons or, you know, squirrels.
Oh, yeah. If you're feeding cats, right? There's people have these feral cat colonies, which is really bad for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
Well, and then they're also feeding, you know, skunks and raccoons and these other things, these predators that are so much more common than they used to be because of the way we've changed the landscape. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these predators and animals are more common. All of these things that do well with suburbia, like the raccoons and the skunks and the crows and the foxes. Mm-hmm. We're aiding and abetting all of those when we feed wildlife in any way. But there's generally more negative consequences to feeding mammals. Mm-hmm. You know.
Although I will say too, you should never feed the gulls. people don't think about this, but it's kind of funny to see them come down and take a French fry out of your hand. But then you got little kids on the beach, and the gulls get used to that, and you could take a finger off those.
Could they take a finger?
I think they could, couldn't they? With those big strong beaks, tiny finger, they could cut them pretty bad. How about that?
Mostly, they just make kids cry when they take their Dorito out of their hand. You know, they get increasingly bold.
Yeah,
you're right. It's not good to feed gulls. And there are people who feed waterfowl for some reason. Like
the ducks and things.
Yeah, I saw somebody doing this in Plymouth. They went to this pond in Plymouth, a little long pond, and they showed up in the pre-dawn hours with like a 25-pound bag of grain from the feed store and just dumped it on the edge of the pond. It was just bizarre. That's terrible. It's terrible for water quality. And so people definitely shouldn't be doing that.
And the thing is that they have good intentions. It's just they don't mean to.
People think they're helping, but they're doing it for them, not for mm-hmm. the birds.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I'm one of those people that feeds things, and I do it for two reasons. One, I don't want my lawn destroyed, but also I think if I feed things, they're less likely to eat baby birds, mice, or whatever they find alive, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it seems to work. I know you don't like the idea.
I don't know about that. What evidence do you have that it works?
Well, because they're here twice a day, just like a dog or a cat, and I feed them great amounts of food. They're fat.
Well, first of all, who's them? And just to back up,
skunks and squirrels.
Okay.
The squirrels get pecans, shelled pecans, and those are high in protein and fat. And the skunks get cat food in enormous quantities. I mean,
wow.
I've had them before I started.
Oh, please stop doing that! Good God!
What?
Holy cow! Yeah, do not do that. It's just not good. I mean, it's just not a good thing to do. I mean, you're getting these animals used, and it is different. To go back to the previous caller's question, I mean, a chickadee would be in your yard anyway. They don't need the food. They'll come and go as they please. They'll come and use your feeder, but then they don't need it if you stop feeding. But skunks are already sort of overpopulated. I mean, not right now. They seem to be dealing with a lot of distemper, but in some years, they're already above what their normal population levels should be. And you're not reducing predation, you're increasing predation on birds. It's the same thing with outdoor cats.
I have had skunks in my yard for years, and I did not feed them. Mm-hmm. And they were a real problem around the barn and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so I have found I've had to do this, and they eat and they leave, and I keep water out for the birds, and obviously they drink the water. I change it twice a day so it's nice and clean.
Mm-hmm. Janet, that gets expensive. Your pecans and cat food.
Good Lord.
I mean, how can you?
Well,
I should eat so well.
Well, you know what? I enjoy animals, and actually they're quite tame now. I do have deer that come in. I don't feed the deer, but they eat whatever they want to, including my peach tree.
Yeah.
One year I had 12 peaches on it, and then I went out one day, and there was one left.
One probably too high for them to reach. Mm. Janet, thanks for...
I don't know what it was, but they trimmed the peach tree
quite boy.
violently. But yeah. I don't know. It works for me,
All right.
And I know it's probably a bad thing to do, but the skunks were a real problem before I did this. I mean, they were everywhere all over my property, trying to get into the barn and stuff like that, and I just cannot have that.
So your argument is that there are fewer skunks now that you're feeding them cat food. I find this hard to believe.
I find that there are fewer skunks on my property. They come and eat, and they leave. Mm-hmm. And they eat great quantities, so I don't think they're hungry. They are all fat.
Yeah.
I know I'm not going to convince you, but it's a terrible idea for everybody else listening. Please don't do that.
The other thing I don't do is I don't feed birds in the summer because I figure There's enough insects around.
There's lots of stuff.
There's no point in feeding rats and mice in the summertime.
Yeah,
right?
You're right about that. All right, Janet. Thanks for the call. We got to move on. Thank you for calling. Yeah. Carl in Acushnet says, "Hi, I have seen several painted ladies over the last few days. These are butterflies. I did see one monarch on May 31st, although I don't usually see them until late in the summer or early fall. On the plus side, I have seen male and female rose-breasted grosbeaks, and it has been a banner year for orioles. I'm seeing young orioles at the jelly feeder now. Plus, it's been a great year for hummers. They empty the three feeders in 2 days, so there's plenty showing up daily. I do have tropical milkweed and some in flower and some younger ones to feed the monarch when they show up later. The 6-foot-tall hollyhock is feeding very many bees and seems to be their favorite, and hopefully they will go pollinate the veggies. P.S. I picked my first tomato on July 4th and now get a supply of them daily." Boy, Carl, I want to check out. Tomatoes in the beginning of July? Holy moly.
That was a very thorough report from Carl Jarrett. Where does he live that
Acushnet.
He has Acushnet. Okay, rose-breasted grosbeak would be hard to come by on the Cape proper here. Well, good for you. Yeah. Rose-breasted grosbeak's a nice bird. Painted ladies, maybe. There are two nearly identical species. The American lady is the more common one. They have two big eye spots underneath. The painted ladies have four. I didn't really see either yesterday. So one American lady, which was unusual. They were really uncommon yesterday. So good for Carl.
Carl checks in pretty regularly with us when Roberta is on. So, Carl, thanks for that. We appreciate that. All right, so we were talking about ospreys earlier, and we need to mention this osprey rescue that happened in Dennis.
This was a great story. Yeah. Susan Wellington is a really good nature photographer, just sort of an amateur nature photographer who does magazine-quality stuff routinely, and she shares some of our stuff with us at Mass Audubon. And she keeps an eye on, some osprey nests, particularly this one Lower County Road and Swan River in Dennis. And she noticed that one of the chicks are getting big now, and one of them was entangled in fishing line, which happens a lot. And so she called Wildcare. Wildcare kind of facilitated some officials in Dennis getting involved, the animal control officer, and then ultimately the fire department was able to rescue this chick and get it disentangled. So it was a really great story. A lot of good people, doing good things. A lot of different people involved in saving that baby osprey from, certain death.
Well, that's a nice story. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point, and it is Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So
I just wanted to go back. I somehow missed that our skunk feeding friend was on the vineyard. I just want to point out that skunks are one of the main predators on piping plover nests on the vineyard, where they don't have some of the other mammalian predators.
Like
so
coyotes,
by feeding skunks, she's undoubtedly, increasing predation on plover nests, whether she thinks so or not.
Okay. Migratory shorebirds already heading south. What? It's barely summer.
I know. It's ridiculous. So these migratory shorebirds that nest in the Arctic, and they start heading south by the first week in July. So they're like the bird equivalent of those back-to-school ads that start showing up in the papers, like midsummer. You remember when you were a kid?
Yeah.
It was
like, wait,
why?
No. Yeah.
Why is the word school in the ads in the newspapers? It's like, I'm not done with summer yet. And so these shorebirds that start, they think it's fall, and they're flying south, and it's like mid-July. Like, what are you doing? No, we just started summer. Go away. But these are birds that nest in often high Arctic places. Wet coastal tundra and near Barrow, Alaska or something like that. And so they have a very short, breeding season, and they're done. It's really June, is it? There's probably still snow when they go back late May, early June, and they have one nest, and they either fledge young or they don't, and then they migrate again. And they're already heading south. Some of them have to get to South America. Some of them may only go to Florida, but they're just, they're on their way.
They're on their way.
And they might spend a good bit of time, it's, I'm losing it here, at these different staging areas, places like the productive flats of Chatham, you know, South Beach, Monomoy, those places. They'll stay there for a while, fattening up, getting ready for their flight to South America. But it's just funny to think about. And it's not just shorebirds. There are some songbirds that are already done. Yellow warblers, which are kind of locally common in shrubby, wet areas around the Cape. And they pretty quickly finish up breeding and start dispersing, kind of like a pre-migratory dispersal. And I start hearing like the flight calls that they give in migration already in July. And then by the end of August, things like orchard orioles are already gone. So some of these songbirds are already thinking about Central America again, even though the rest of us feel like we just started summer.
Like, not yet. Yep. All right. Sue is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Sue.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I'm calling with a story about a turkey chick, or I guess they're called poults, rescue in my yard in Falmouth. And it's kind of a nice little charming story. I got a call from my daughter, who's 17. I was at work. And she said, there's a hurt animal outside. I said, well, go see what it is. And she did, looked around for a little bit and saw a turkey in the bushes. And upon further examination, saw that it had a bunch of chicks with it. And they were probably about 4 inches high. And I thought, gee, that's small for this time of year. Anyway, she stayed there and was kind of calling and calling kind of excitedly over and over. And then my daughter heard another from another direction. And one of her chicks had fallen into a storm drain. So I said, I'll make some calls. I called the animal center, the animal control officer, MSPCA. I called everywhere. Finally, I called the DPW. And they sent a young man out to our street. And this young man tried his very best to get the chick. He took the storm drain off, but it was scared and went over into the corner where no one could reach it.
Oh, no.
Oh.
So he called another DPW guy who brought a net. And just as the other DPW truck was driving up our street, my daughter remembered that she had recorded the mother turkey calling for her chick. And she played it, and the baby chick came right to where they could reach it.
Oh, my goodness.
Brilliant.
Your daughter is so smart.
She is so smart, and we both love animals so much. We've done quite a few rescues of different birds. So... she pulled the baby chick out, or actually the DPW guy pulled the chick out, and it ran. We have a video of it running to its mother.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's
a wonderful video.
Yeah, this has the makings of a viral video. Did you post that?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. I have it, but I didn't. This is
you should post it.
Oh, you're going to go viral.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I told my neighbors about it, but that's all until you.
Yeah. Oh, and no. You should post
that. I saw the mother and her babies about a half mile from my house.
Aww.
So
what a great story.
Well, we have so many bad bird endings. I like that we have a story with a happy bird ending. Thanks for sharing that. So, yeah, that was really smart.
You're welcome.
Good work.
Yeah, thinking of recording that and then using that's very
saving
good.
The poult.
Very smart. All right, John's calling from East Harwich. Hi, John.
Hi. I've got another turkey story. We've got a lot of turkeys in the neighborhood, as do a lot of people on the Cape. And not so long ago, a bunch of maybe half a dozen of them flew out of the trees and crossed the road and went to our neighbor's yard. And I'd never seen them flying before, but I know they do nest in trees. But amongst the six turkeys, there was a white one. And it behaved like all the other turkeys, and he was accepted like all the other turkeys, but I'd never seen a white turkey before.
Yeah. Just to clarify, I think you meant, I'm guessing you meant to say roost in trees. They nest on the ground, but roost at night, they roost in trees, and it's the craziest thing to watch. You see this 22-pound awkward bird that looks like it's like barely able to fly, just crashing up into the pines. I see it at work a lot at the sanctuary at Wellfleet, but they do nest on the ground. And we get this question, you know, these white turkeys turn up, and the question is always, Is this a naturally occurring albino, or more likely, does it have domestic poultry gene? So the domestic turkeys are white. You've probably seen them. The president pardons one of these white domestic turkeys every year, and you know, some people keep them and they'll get out and they can breed with wild turkeys. So you know, it's one of those two, and I need to look into it a little bit more. But if you had pictures of it, it might help. Was it just pure white? I mean, did it look like just a domestic turkey, or did it have some brown feathers too?
Well, no, it seemed to be pure white, but it was the same size and shape as the other turkeys. It was a female.
Yeah. Anybody in the area keep poultry? It's hard to know. I mean, people... Yeah, people keep all kinds of crazy things that you wouldn't know about. There's somebody in my neighborhood has pheasants, and I hear them. They have this crazy, you know, exotic sounding call that just like echoes across. They're like three streets away, but I hear. I'm sorry, peacocks.
Yeah, peacocks. Yeah, they're loud.
Pheasants.
Yeah,
just gotta learn my birds better. Peacocks are very loud.
I've seen a white peacock. There used to be one in East Falmouth. I think it was somebody moved them.
A white one.
A white one, yeah. But they had, you know, the other colorful ones too.
Right. Yeah. It's a little different, but you can still buy all kinds of quail. Somebody saw a California quail, I think it was, at Forest Beach in Chatham. Somebody ordered it through the mail. You know, you can keep them.
Yeah,
you can keep them like you would keep chickens. But even though it's a native wild bird of the U.S., so there are all kinds of interesting exotic birds out there. But that may in fact just be a domestic turkey that got out there.
Yeah. All right, John. Thanks for the question. All right. So we heard that great story about the rescue of the little baby turkey. And there's lots of baby birds around right now, and we saw a dead baby bird the other day, and it was very sad, but it happens a lot. But what happened?
Yeah.
But you can find lots of things in your yard right now, and if you see a baby bird, we say this all the time, just leave it alone.
It depends. There's sort of like a question tree you have to go through. Like,
right.
Is it naked and, you know, helpless? Right. In which case it needs help, but it needs to be put back in a nest.
But little ones bouncing around, they're okay.
Right. But, and I dealt with this, a friend of mine from high school that I, you know, haven't talked to in years, just emailed me like, help, there's baby blue jays and the mother's going crazy and they seem like they shouldn't be out of the nest, but they were just recently fledged, you know, and they look like they shouldn't quite be out of the nest. They have feathers, but the feathers are all really short and they look sort of ridiculous and awkward. But that's how songbirds often fledge. You know, you see these robins that don't look like they should be out of the nest, but the parents just stash them in the bushes somewhere individually, and then they find them and feed them. They keep feeding them once they're out of the nest, and it's not something that requires action on the part of anybody. But certainly younger ones that are still naked, if a nest actually fell or something like that, you would want to try to get them back in a nest or, you know, call wild care or something like that. But yeah, dead baby birds is a thing. It's just part of the circle of life. And we had something at my house that happened right under my nose. And I'm somebody who's done bird research around the country, often focused on finding and monitoring songbird nests. And so I should have known better. But so I had these Carolina wrens nesting in a flower box just attached to the side of the house right next to our back door onto our deck, our primary, it's where we spend all our time. And, you know, we watched these Carolina wrens, they seemed to be building a nest, and then it seemed like they weren't around anymore. And I was like, oh, it seems like they're not going to build the nest after all. And then I look in there and there's five eggs. Like, oh, they're pretty quiet about it. And so we're monitoring this nest. I took pictures of the eggs, but didn't really look at them. And then I could sort of see the chicks later on, like, you know, they hatched right around Father's Day. And, you know, I took some phone photos because it was hard to see. I would stick my phone in there and take a photo to see what was going on in the nest. And I didn't notice anything was wrong. And then all of a sudden, a week before they should have fledged, the parents were feeding a cowbird chick right in our yard in the shrubs. Mm-hmm. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Yep. How did I miss that? And I was like, why are they feeding a cowbird chick? They need to be feeding their own nestlings. And I look in the nest and there's just an unhatched egg and a dead Carolina wren chick.
Yep.
That's all
Those
that was left in there.
Yeah.
And so I went back and looked at my photos, and sure enough, there was a cowbird egg in there when I had first photographed the eggs, and I'm just slapping myself on the forehead like, I've seen cowbird eggs. I've dealt with this, different research projects I've been involved with. And it just happened right under my nose.
Right. And so for people who don't know about the cowbird, tell them about
it. Yeah. So brown-headed cowbird is a really common blackbird, closely related to red-winged blackbirds. But they have this very unique lifestyle where they don't make their own nests. The females just lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, and they lay lots and lots of these eggs in hopes that the other birds will raise their chicks. And it works because mm-hmm. they're a very common bird. And they used to be less common. They used to sort of follow the buffalo across the plains, and they didn't used to be able to get into the interior of the big primeval forests, the kind of pre-colonial forests. But because we fragmented the landscape so much with suburbia and other development and agriculture, they have access to a lot more songbirds. Mm-hmm. And they've been the cause of declines of some endangered songbirds in other parts of the country. But anyway, they're very good at what they do, and they're very good at finding nests and parasitizing them. They're what's called an obligate brood parasite, meaning they can't raise their own young. They have to get other birds to do it. It's pretty interesting, pretty interesting bird in a lot of ways. But some species that they parasitize will reject it. They'll abandon the nest and start over. But you know, a lot of times they don't, and so that cowbird chick grows faster. It gets most of the food. Sometimes they'll push the other chicks out of the nest. We never found any, but I'm not sure what happened to the other ones. And so, you know, they're very well adapted to this lifestyle. They fledge much quicker than the other ones.
Is the Carolina wren still feeding it?
I think it is. They've sort of moved more out into the periphery, but they were around this morning again, and it sounded like they were still feeding that cowbird chick.
Wow.
And it's probably, they're probably not going to be able to nest again, but it just... I could have just taken that cowbird egg out.
And everything would have been fine.
Interfered with nature, as it were. But
All right, so you actually have a talk coming up at Friends of the National Seashore, right? What's that about?
July 18th. I'm talking about Peru, the various birding trips I've done to Peru and the incredible avian diversity there. And
lots of pictures?
From the Amazon, lots of pictures, from the Amazon rainforest up to the super high elevations around Machu Picchu and Machu Picchu. And so it's an incredible country, 1,900 bird species, and I've been very lucky to go there a few different times. Going to be going there again in November, I think, and then again next year. So I look forward to that. There's another talk, if people are interested, in the wildlife of Monomoy. My good friend Kate Iaquinto is giving a talk that same night, competing with me, talking about the birds and other wildlife of Monomoy, and all the different research that they do there.
Is there something other than birds and seals on Monomoy?
Other than birds and seals, there's tiger beetles.
Oh, okay.
And that's one of their active projects. There's sea beech amaranth, an endangered or a listed plant species they do conservation work with. So, yeah, it's more than just the tern colony. And lately, a friend of mine, Sean Williams and Miley Waters, they've been out there documenting all kinds of really rare waterfowl that breed out there and breed potentially nowhere else in Massachusetts.
Oh, that's cool.
At the south end, where they don't get to do as much work down there. But
anyway, so that's
the same night. That's
at
July
Salt
18th.
Pond Visitor Center
my
yours.
Talk is at Salt Pond Visitor Center, and then Kate's, I think, the Chatham.
And they're both at
Community Center
7:30?
There, I would guess.
They're both at
7-ish somewhere, whatever.
Okay.
Look them up.
All right. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, joins us the second Tuesday of every month. Thank you, Mark.
Catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.